Randy Ross is a Somerville-based writer, lecturer, and performer. His comedic novel, God Bless Cambodia, was published in 2017 by Permanent Press, an independent press specializing in literary fiction. His one-man show, The Chronic Singles Handbook, has been featured at theater festivals in the U.S., Canada, Edinburgh, Scotland. And in 2007, he took a trip around the world and learned to say in three languages, speak English, got Pepto-Bismol, and where is the evacuation helicopter? The novel and one-man show were inspired by the trip. God bless him. Cambodia is a picaresque comedy about a never-married hypochondriac who takes a trip around the world, hoping to change his luck with love. It's an unflinching look at how men feel about sex, love, marriage, and massage parlors. The book features adult situations, adult language, and more adult situations. Booklist calls it an entertaining tale about a guy who sets out to change his life. And I guess Randy changed his life because previously he was an executive editor at PC World Magazine, where he and got a master's degree in journalism from Northwestern University. So, Randy.
Great. Thanks, Henry. I also want to thank Amanda and the Gloucester Writers Association for having me up here. So tonight, just real quick, the agenda. I have a presentation. It's about 45 minutes. The first part of it is about this trip I took, which became the basis for the novel. And the second half is kind of my process of getting the novel published. Rabies. Plague, cholera, Japanese encephalitis, dengue fever, yellow fever, diphtheria, dysentery. That's a few of the things I was about to face on a four-month solo trip around the world. According to the experts, I wasn't supposed to drink the water, eat the food, or kiss the women. Walking barefoot and swimming in fresh water were definitely out. But there was one thing I feared more than any ghastly third world disease. Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. So this whole thing takes place in 2007. I've been working at PC World Magazine. I was there for 15 years. I got laid off, and I was pretty upset about this. And apparently my girlfriend was upset about it because she dumped me at the same time. So this is one of those situations where I was, I'm a little bit of a depressive, so I was moping around the house, and then I started moping around the local bookstore, and I found myself in the travel section. And I started thumbing through all the travel guidebooks, you know, Lonely Planet, Rough Guides. And the one thing I noticed about every one of these books is they all had a juicy, titillating passage on sexually transmitted diseases. So part of me was like, eh. Another part of me was like, nonstop party. So I went ahead and I booked a four-month solo trip around the world. And I went, here's the trip. 4 months, five continents, eight countries. I started in Venezuela. Then I went to Greece, South Africa, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Australia, New Zealand. And I had a rotten, crappy, miserable time. I wouldn't recommend this to anybody. And I take some responsibility for this. Some of it's my fault. Prior to taking this trip, I hadn't done much traveling. I'd been to France, I'd been to Mexico, I'd been to Canada. And I'm not really a particularly adventurous person. But I am a writer, so I went ahead and, you know, all these books tell you how to book the trip yourself. So I went ahead and did it. And then after I had bought all the tickets, then I started doing some more research. And one of the things I found was this map on the Center for Disease Control websites. And this is a map of the hotspots for diarrhea around the world. And if you notice, the places I was going and the places on the hotspots, I was going to be hitting all the diarrhea hotspots. And diarrhea, the medical name is dysentery. So just when I mentioned dysentery in the opening, this is dysentery. Another thing one of the diseases I found that was really kind of yucked me out was something called guinea worm disease. Anybody heard of this? You're a nurse. Okay, so actually, let me give you, for those of you who haven't heard of it, here's a nice photo of, so the way guinea worm disease works is, we'll leave another diary of slow. Is that better? Okay. Do you want me to describe the guinea worm disease, or we just want to move on? Henry, do you want to hear this?
How did it get its
There you go. Okay, so the way it works is you drink infected water, and it's typically in Africa. You swallow these organisms, and they grow, and they grow, and they grow. And within a year, they turn into a worm that's about 3 feet long, and it kind of moves around under your skin. And when it's ready to reproduce, it
pops out.
We'll skip that photo. But yeah, it kind of does this kind of thing. The other thing, this is a little cleaner, but the other thing I learned the hard way is that I'm not really a sightseer. I didn't really know this. So I'm in Greece, and I'm going to see the ruins, and yeah, as far as I'm concerned, that looks like an unfinished parking garage. So, and then I went to Cambodia, which is known for Angkor Wat, which is one of the largest religious structures in the world. So I set the indoor...
It would be one of seven vortexes, so it should have been life-changing.
Mm. No. Actually, maybe it was, because I set the indoor land speed record for getting in and out of this place. So, it was just more gray stones. So basically, my motto after seeing this was, like, if you've seen one pile of moss-covered rubble, you've kind of seen them all. So this was not something I was that interested in.
You're going to get an uglier picture then, man, because that's like...
So yeah, gorgeous. Well, that's... Look, it's all gray.
It's all
gray. And actually, when I went, the pine cones were closed for... You know, they were fixing them or something. Everything's gray. The whole thing is gray except for the monks in the orange robes. The other thing, and this was something, I don't know whether it's my fault or the travel book's fault, but the reality of budget travel, because if you're going on this, you're traveling for 4 months, you're going on the cheap, especially if you're doing it yourself. One of the things was all my flights were red, a lot of them were red-eye flights. There were multiple stops. At one point, I had 3 red-eye flights in a month, and one of the flights from South Africa to Bangkok was 32 hours, and the reason it was 32 hours, it wasn't flying 32 hours, is every time I had a stop, I made sure that there was a 5-hour stopover window, so if the plane arrives late, or if I have problems getting through customs, because I'm going from one country to another country, and they're also checking, you know, your yellow card to see what diseases you've had and what shots you've had. So I had 2 stopovers. Actually, I might have had 3. So that's just 15 hours of hanging around the airport, and then the flights themselves. Another thing about budget travel is you're not staying in Hyatt Regencies every night, or at least I'm not. So you're staying in hostels, and you're staying with kids, college kids, high school kids. And there's a photo of, so I'm out with a bunch of kids. Yeah, they're all, you know, having a great time, and I'm doing the best I can down in the lower right-hand corner. So earlier I mentioned the one thing I feared more than any ghastly third world disease, and that was this baby right here. Does anyone ever use one of these? This is a squat toilet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, you didn't have a problem?
No.
Okay.
Not my favorite, but yeah.
Does anyone want me to go into detail on how this works? Yeah, see that bucket?
Yeah.
The green bucket, you dip it into the big blue bucket, and when you're done, you fling it down that hole. And what I did is I just ran out of there as fast as I could because it was started oozing back out of the... And I have a... In my book, I have a fictitious... I'm not going to read it. I won't read it. But I have a big, very detailed description of this. So this was about, you know, budget travel. But there were also... Some of these books, there were some inaccuracies in some of the travel brochures. Exaggerated a little bit. So one thing I went to, I went to Greece and I went windsurfing, and this is kind of what I was expecting. You know, I was a beginner windsurfer, so, you know, something, you know, between 10 and 15 miles an hour is kind of what I was hoping for. And I get to Greece, I was in an island called Karpathos. Any of you guys windsurfers? Okay, this is a big hot place in Europe for windsurfing, And this is more of kind of what I experienced. So, I mean, the wind was, you know, 30 miles an hour. And I spent, you know, one day in the water, and then I just spent the rest of the time in the bar. So this was not so accurate. Another issue was some of the places that were recommended. So Lonely Planet recommended this place called The King in Phnom Penh. So in Southeast Asia, you stay in places called guest houses. And a guest house, when I hear a guest house, I think of, you know, like a Vermont B&B, and you can have like blueberry pancakes in the morning. This is a scene out of the book, but it's inspired by this actual place that I stayed in. It's after midnight, and the King lobby is secured by a locked metal gate. I can just see a night watchman snoozing in a hammock draped with a ripped mosquito net. I tap on the gate. The man jumps up to let me in. I tip him a dollar. He gives me a little bow and climbs back into the hammock. As I start toward the darkened stairs, something lumbers around. A couch bolts past the hammock and settles under a melamine end table. The creature is too large to be a squirrel and too small to be a Rottweiler. I crouch for a better look. It's a half-bald rat. I follow the guidebook's advice for encounters with Cambodian wildlife and look for threatening gestures. Teeth gnashing, hair bristling, back arching, foot drumming, growling, ear flattening, tail between the legs, backward earth flinging with hind feet. The night watchman snores. The rat remains still, watching me. I check for foaming mouth, cowering pups nearby, teardrop tattoos around the eyes. All clear, but the bald spot bothers me. I rub my smooth-shaven head and tiptoe to the staircase, giving the rat a wide berth. Sit. Stay, I whisper. The nightman doesn't stir. So, yeah, for those in the podcast, this is a lobby, and there's a large rat right in the middle of it. Yes. maybe. Another place that was recommended, so I mentioned that I went to Angkor Wat, and I couldn't get out of there fast enough. But when you go to Angkor Wat, you stay in a town next door called Siem Reap. And in Siem Reap, one of the things they recommended was going to see the crocodile farm. So I went to the crocodile farm, and you know, there's all these, you know, lizards. They're about 16, 18 feet long. They're pretty big, kind of cool. And the one thing I noticed was, okay, so here's an aerial view of the crocodile farm, and we see there's a wall, where the red arrow is, there's a wall, and on the other side of the wall, there was a swimming hole filled with kids. So that was the crocodile farm. Another place that was recommended to me, I didn't actually go, but I talked to some people about it, and it was a shooting range called Thunder Ranch. And the way this supposedly worked was you go to Thunder Ranch, it was just outside Phnom Penh, and they give you a menu. And column A are drinks, martinis, beer, you know, whatever you want. And then there's another column with Soviet-era weapons that you can fire. So rocket launchers, machine guns, grenades. And then there's another column that has farm animals. So you can pick something from A, column A, B, and C. And if you want to, like, blow up a cow with a rocket launcher, you can do that. If you want to kill a bunch of chickens with a machine gun, that's an option as well. So this was Thunder Ranch. I didn't make it to Thunder Ranch, but a lot of the brochures were recommending it. And I guess I mentioned about the college kids, so here they are again. So at this point in the trip, this is New Zealand. I'm a little depressed. I've been traveling for 4 months, not having a particularly good time. I hadn't contracted any sexually transmitted diseases, so the whole trip was kind of a bust. So I'm one of those people, when I get depressed, I kind of like electroshock myself, kind of snap out of the mood. So I went bungee jumping.
So that little plank that they walk you on is about the size of this notebook computer. And they walk you out to the end, and you turn around and ask them, are you sure this is a really good idea? And then they just like give you a little shove. Should I do this? Yeah, we don't care. Go ahead. Knock yourself out. And then you jump, and you yell, Mommy. So the thing about this is that I'd gone skydiving before, and this is much scarier. Because if you go skydiving, you look out and everything, you know, you're up so high, everything looks kind of fuzzy and soft and surreal. This, when you're on that little platform and looking down, you can see every rock. And I did this 3 times. I would never do it again. I didn't have any problems, but apparently some people have had problems with it.
New Year's Eve, a 22-year-old Australian, Erin Langworthy's bungee jump over the Zambezi River has a certain style as she sets off. Then disaster as her jumping cord snaps and she plunges into the crocodile-infested waters.
It went black straight away and I felt like I'd been slapped all over.
She came to in the swirling rapids, but with her feet tied together, still not out of danger.
I actually had to swim down and yank the bungee cord out of whatever it was caught into.
Erin eventually managed to reach the bank of the river, where rescuers pulled her out battered and bruised. But even then, her ordeal wasn't over.
When I was first pulled out of the water, they put me on my back. And so all the water that I'd inhaled meant that I couldn't breathe. So I made them roll me onto my side. And that's when I started coughing out water and blood.
The safari company that organized the jump calls it 111 meters of pure adrenaline on its website. But another look at Erin's jump shows just how lucky she was.
Yes, I think it's definitely a miracle that I survived.
Nazanin Sadri, Al Jazeera.
So I didn't see anything like that happen. I didn't have any problems, but I did it in South Africa. And a lot of these countries, they don't have these liability laws that we have here. So in South Africa, there's basically 2 paragraphs. You sign this form, and it basically says, you know, if you get killed, tough shit. Yeah, 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 bummer. So this trip, 4 months, rotten time, but actually it was good preparation for trying to get a book published. So that's going to be the second half of my presentation. I'm on this trip, having a bad time, lonely, depressed, and I'm a writer, so I kept a blog the whole trip. And by the time I got home, I had 120 pages of blog material. So it was all, you know, kvetching and moaning and more kvetching and more moaning, but I had 120 pages of stuff. And this was end of 2007. I was gone for 4 months. And so I had all this material. And this was around the time that travel memoirs were doing pretty well. So one of them was Eat, Pray, Love. By this point, she had sold 5 million copies. This other book, Sex Lives of Cannibals, it's a guy's travel book. It was very funny. He didn't sell nearly as many as she did. So there were books out there, and I was like, I'm a writer. I worked for a computer magazine. I can do this. So I spent a year and a half taking writing classes, joining writers' groups, going to writers' conferences. And at the end of a year and a half, I had a travel memoir. And I went to see an agent at a conference, writers' conference, and the agent said, you know what? There's no market for travel memoirs anymore. Make it a memoir. So this is back in, you know, the movie Running with Scissors had just come out. That was based on a book by Augustine Burroughs. He had just come out with another book called Dry. Anybody familiar with this book, A Million Little Pieces? Everybody familiar with this? Yeah, so it started out as a novel, and he couldn't sell it. So then he said, you know what? Actually, it's all true, so it's a memoir. And he sold a lot of copies of this.
But it wasn't all true.
It wasn't all true, yeah. But I figured if he could lie about it, I could do that also. So I spent another year and a half taking writing classes, joining writing groups, going to conferences, and I went to talk to an agent, and the agent said to me, actually, you know what? There's no market for memoirs anymore unless you're a Kennedy, and my little Photoshop thing didn't fool anybody. So the guy said, agent I talked to said, your best bet as a debut writer is a novel. So I spent another year and a half writing classes, writing groups, went to another conference, showed what I had to an agent. And the agent, I swear this is true, the agent said, you know what? This might make a good travel memoir. So at this point, I was actually, I was kind of like this. No, I don't like public speaking. So at this point, I didn't know what to do. And I got a hotel room down on the Cape, and I was down there for 2 days, and I was like, you know what? The novel's been the most fun. That's what I'm gonna work on. So this is kind of the, can't really see that. Okay. I spent another year and a half writing groups, writing classes. And actually what I did was I was taking classes down at Grub Street, and one of the women that was in one of my classes, her comments were better than the instructor's comments. I was in a writer's group with her, and her comments were really good. And she had traveled around the world. She had a warped sense of humor. And so I hired her. And I worked with her. I've been working with her for probably 8 years. So she knew something about fiction, and she helped me whip this thing into shape. This is my query letter. I can read it. Actually, you know what? I'm going to read it. So the way I knew that the book was pretty much done is I had this query letter. I was pretty happy with it. And I went to a writer's conference. Grub Street has this Muse in the Marketplace. I paid to see two agents. I showed them both this query letter, and they said, this is okay. So that's kind of how I knew I was ready to start sending the book out. Dear agent, I'm writing because of your diverse client list and interest in commercial fiction. My comedic novel, so at the time, the working title for the book was The Loneliest Planet. My comedic novel, The Loneliest Planet, offers an unflinching look at how men feel about sex, love, marriage, and massage parlors. The audience includes men seeking insight into their own psyches, women seeking insight into men, and anyone interested in a gritty, bittersweet romantic comedy. It should appeal to readers of Jonathan Tropper, Joshua Ferris, and Sam Lipsyte. So that's the first paragraph, and have you guys, well, you know query letters, rest of you guys, but basically the first paragraph is where you describe how it fits into the market, you know, who the competing authors, who authors that write similar stuff, and you want to really boil it down to one or two sentences on what the book's about. And the second and third paragraph, you go into the story. The story follows the picaresque adventures of Randall Burns, yes, he's named after me, 48, chronically single, and recently downsized out of a long-time job. Burns is not your typical rambling man. He hates public toilets, loud noises, weird smells, and people who sweat. Nevertheless, he's tired of wasting his time pounding away on Match.com as if it were a game of whack-a-mole. Prodded by fears of dying alone and snarky emails from ex-girlfriend Ricky, Burns succumbs to the promises of a travel guidebook. He blows his severance on a trip around the world, hoping to change his luck with love. On the trip, Burns strikes out with women on three continents and suffers loneliness that would have broken Papillon. The only thing that keeps him from returning home is Ricky, who continues to email, declaring her certainty that he's having a rotten time and won't last another week. She recounts his failures as a boyfriend, lover, and human being. On the fourth continent, Burns accepts that he's going to die alone, and the sooner, the better. He bungee jumps, eats food from street carts, and visits a body spa named the Curious Finger. He lets go of his germophobia and his quest for a woman and begins to enjoy himself. Ricky emails again. She's now on antidepressants and sorry for her past behavior. Is his luck with love about to change? So that was the query letter. I showed it to these two agents that said it was pretty good. One of the agents said, the query letter's pretty good, but I think the novel's kind of offensive, so I'm not interested in representing you. The one thing he did say, though, was your best bet is to find, an agent or a publisher, young agent, someone that's, a little hip, a little, going to like this kind of edgy stuff a little more. So this agent I was talking to was probably in his early 40s. So he was like, yeah, you know, find someone who's 17 or something. The second agent that I showed it to was a guy about my age. He liked the query letter. He didn't ask for the novel, but I asked him, would you take a look at it? And he said, sure. The one thing that was interesting about this agent was that he had one of his clients had contacted 120 agents before this guy picked him up. The book was called, I forgot, but it was turned into a movie, and it'll come back to me a little later on. But
what was the movie?
The movie did much better than the book. At my age, it'll come back. Anyway, so I had this number in my head, 120 agents. So how do you find 120 agents? Okay, so here's my spreadsheet. I would send out 5 query letters a day. Out of 100, I ended up contacting 110 agents. I got 7 requests for manuscripts, so it's like, I think that's 1 out of 17. So 110 agents, 50 of them said, go take a hike. 7 of them wanted the manuscript and then said, go take a hike. And 50 of them just didn't respond. I mean, this is something I can go into another time. Where you find 110 agents, and you found even more than I did. Yeah, it can be done. There are plenty of agents out there. Here are some of the tools. I'm not going to get into these are all up on my website. One of the things that's worth mentioning is when you start looking for an agent, you know, there's all this wisdom out there on what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And one of the things a lot of people say if an agent doesn't respond, that means they're not interested. And I read someplace that's hogwash, and what you should do is wait 6 weeks and then contact the agent again. So what I did was I waited 6 weeks, and what I would do is I would find the original email query letter that I sent to the agent. I would hit reply all so that the subject would say regarding my query letter, so it looks like we had some kind of discussion before. And then I put a nice note in saying, I sent this a few months back, didn't hear back from you, just want to make sure it didn't get caught in your spam filter. So I did this a bunch of times. 2 agents said, oh, actually, I never saw it. Send me the manuscript. And then they didn't want it. But so this was something where persistence and, you know, following conventional wisdom doesn't always work. So 110 agents, about halfway through the process, I was like, I'd gone through like 50 agents. And I was like, you know what? There's a good chance this is not going to happen. So I started sending, I started contacting small presses. So the way the process generally works is if you want to get a big publisher, the big dough, you got to get an agent. And if you can't get an agent, which I couldn't, then you start contacting publishers directly, because some of them will take stuff directly from a writer. I contacted 10 small presses, and one of them, called the Permanent Press, was interested. The thing that's interesting about these guys is, first of all, they've been around for 35 years. It's a husband and wife that run it. They put out 16 books a year. So they've been doing this for a while, and they're both in their 80s. So they're not 17-year-old agents or, you know, young hipsters, but they're a small press, and they publish what they like. And normally what they publish are, like, literary mystery, and why they took a comedy, they said they liked it. It's not what they normally publish. Another important thing is you always want to read the guidelines. So these guys, they're old school because they're old, so they want paper. So they were at the bottom of my list because, email is easy. You just send them the query letter, send them the manuscript. These guys wanted paper. So it says in the guidelines, send the first 20 pages. I sent the first 20 pages. A week later, I got an email said send the rest of the manuscript, mail it. So I had to go down and print out 330 pages, put it in a box, send it to these guys. I waited a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I still hadn't heard from them, which I thought was probably a good sign, because usually if they don't want something, they'll let you know right away. And then I got a phone call from them one night saying, we like the book, we want to buy it, we're going to send you a contract. So, well, it's not over yet, but thank you. Yeah, it's just, no, it gets worse. It gets worse rather than better. So here's this is a section on how not to negotiate a contract with a small press. So they send me this contract. It's 2 pages. And, you know, I've been reading all this stuff on the internet about, you know, publishers, they're out to rip you off, and you're an author, and you've got rights, and don't take any crap from these guys. So they sent me the contract, and my advance was $1,000. And I said, I want to talk to a lawyer first. So I spent $350 on a lawyer, and he goes through the contract, and he says, you know, this is pretty standard stuff for a small publisher, but I got a couple suggestions. So I'm looking through the contract, you know, I write down all his suggestions. I'm pretty worked up about this. I'm a Jewish guy from New York, so you get really wound up about this stuff. And so you can't really see this, but I put together basically decision trees. If he says this, I'm going to say that. You know, if then, all this stuff, I was prepared. I had this all written down on a document. And before I was about to call him, I called my father. So my father's in his 80s, had small businesses his whole life. He knows how to negotiate a contract. So I was like, Dad, I'm getting ready to close the deal. Do you have any advice? And he said, well, how many other offers do you have? And I was like, I don't have any. He was like, shut up and sign the contract. So I call the publisher, and I start going through the list of stuff that the lawyer had given me, and the publisher says, you know what? You're giving me a headache. Yeah. So I said, fine, I signed the contract. The next step in the process is they send you the cover. So they sent me this cover, which I wasn't that happy about. You know, this is my book's, you know, literary fiction. But, you know, why is there a beer bottle in the middle of this? You know, it should be like a martini glass or cabernet, you know, some champagne flute. And here they've got a beer bottle. You know, the Buddha's holding a beer bottle.
I like it.
My friends did like, so I didn't like it. My friends didn't like it. But the other thing they sent me was, so this was my author photo. And I was like, yeah, I was like, well, so I sent this to my friends. Some of them had, you know, been in publishing, and they said, you know, they're supposed to send you two options for a book cover. And they only sent me one. So there was this one, and there was this one. And I liked this one better. My friends liked this one better. And so I got a little worked up, called my father, sent these both of these images to my parents. My father wasn't home, so my mother picks up the phone, and I said, Ma, you know, I'm about to call a publisher. What do you think? And she says, so, Mr. Big Shot, they've been in publishing for 35 years. How long have you been in publishing, book publishing? I was like, well, Ma, is a month. Shut up and take the cover. So that's what I did. But it's
that's the way you're going to show up at the door.
I wish. Yeah, and because they put Angkor Wat in the glasses. Yeah. This is stuff that their art graphics person did. I thought they did a great job with this.
So you have Angkor Wat on the left. What's on the right?
That's part of the same photo. That's the trees.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No. Would have thought it was some other place in the world, but
You know, you could be right. I thought that was from that similar to the photo that I showed, but you guys may be right. Maybe it is some. It could be someplace else. So this is not over yet. The way this works, so the publisher sent me a contract, and they also sent me this author letter, which is basically, you know, this is the realities of the book market, especially if you know this is your first time author. And so, you know, it says, basically the gist is, if you don't get any reviews, there's no book. And it says right in the contract, generally speaking, books by non-celebrities sell between 700 and 1,500 copies. To even ensure that many sales, it is imperative that the pre-publication reviews be good ones. So the book was supposed to come out in March 2017, November 2016, they send the book out to reviewers. So they send it out in November, December, January. They sent it out. You know, so they sent it to Kirkus, and they sent it to Publishers Weekly, and they sent it to all these places, a place called Booklist, which is what librarians read for book ideas. So
did they take back your $1,000 if you didn't get any reviews?
No. But what would happen is, so I got a call from the publisher. On just January 10th, 2017, nobody reviewed the book. He said basically we'll do an ebook copy, but there's no book. And I was, trying to negotiate. Well, what if I buy a bunch, or, I have all these friends on Twitter, and he was like, there's no review, no book. So that was January 10th. So, the next week I'm on my phone crying to my therapist. And then 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from the publisher. And he's very sweet on the phone. Very nice. And he said, yeah, your book just got reviewed by Kirkus. Mm-hmm. And the review isn't great. It's not bad. But, the pull quote is, this story of a flawed character's midlife crisis becomes an easy one to relate to. That doesn't sound particularly good to me, but the publisher was happy with it, so they went ahead and they took the review, they boiled it down, they bought an ad in Publishers Weekly. This is the ad. So, they were happy with the review. And then a couple weeks later, I got a review in Booklist, so this one was better. A very entertaining story about a guy who sets out to change his life, and, they write more nice stuff in there. So again, this is small press, so the marketing stuff, they bought the ad, but that was basically what they were going to do with it. So the rest of it was up to me. I can skip over this. I don't know if any of you guys interested in this. This is marketing stuff, what you have to do to try and sell your book. Do you want to hear? Okay. The best advice I ever got on any kind of marketing for a small business is find something you like and get good at it. So the events, lectures like this, I mentioned I have a one-man show, so performing and talking, lecturing is stuff I like. So I took acting lessons. I developed a one-man show that I'm going to talk about in a second. This is how I was trying to sell books. And the thing about doing events and lectures, and you were talking about where you, Linda, that you're going to have to, your book comes out, you probably will have to do some talks. The good thing about this is they generate publicity. So my show, I do it, they're called Fringe Theater Festivals, so they're independent theater, and there's a circuit all over the U.S. and Canada, and the big one is in Edinburgh, Scotland, and you get reviewed there, you get written up in the local papers. I did one down in Orlando, and I did it for the Florida Writers Association, and this is a write-up on my lecture that was in the St. Augustine Record, which is the city that I was doing my talk in. So you get publicity. Whether this sells any books, I have no idea. But you got to do something. So the other thing I did was,
Your publisher doesn't get back to you saying, hey, you did a good job down there in St. Augustine. We sold 100 books.
If that happened, he probably would call me. That hasn't happened. That hasn't happened. Actually, my total book sales, about 300 copies. So I haven't even reached the small level that he was talking about, and I've been busting my ass. So the one thing I did was a novel is 12 hours of material. I hired a director. We boiled it down into a 1 hour, one man show, and that's what I've been performing at these fringe festivals. And the show is called The Chronic Singles Handbook, and there's photos of me performing. And I get publicity in the local newspapers. I get reviewed, and also I hand out postcards to people at the festival. So on the front of the postcard is where I'm mentioning my show. On the back is where I mention the novel. I usually hand out between 400 and 500 of these at a festival. Is this resulting in book sales? Maybe a few. Friends that I've spoken to. Basically, it's one book at a time. When you're with a small press, you sell one book at a time. If you sell a book, that's a good day, because I'm not selling tens of thousands. I haven't even reached 1,000 yet.
How much is this part, what you're doing now, part of your show there? I mean, you must be borrowing from in these presentations now.
Well, the show is just me talking. I'm in a costume. I've got props around a stage. Some of it's the same material. And actually, this presentation is going to be the basis for a new show that I'm working on. I'm going to mention that in a second.
Well, but you're going to be on Hava's show.
If she,
I think that
Jennifer.
Jenny, sorry, I'm going to time warp here because I know her from another time.
Actually, she's been to my show.
Yeah.
Well, bless her heart.
Get him on the program.
Yeah, you could be a guest in my show.
Okay.
Yeah, why not?
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
It's funny.
He is funny.
Yeah. So that's another thing. I have an email newsletter that I send out. Again, if you guys are interested in any of this stuff, I'm happy to come back and talk to you about it because I'm going to go into it. But stuff
well,
that
happened.
You want?
Because Linda, what do you? I mean, you're in that. Aren't most of the people in your group interested in publishing, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Everybody who's an aspiring writer is.
Yeah.
But so, of course, I find it interesting and discouraging at the same time. And actually going to Grub Street helped me because I was convinced that it doesn't count if you self-publish, but I don't feel that way at all anymore. Go ahead.
I don't want to say it on the podcast. I'll tell you this.
Okay, well, whether you're going to self-publish or whatever you're going to do, you've got to sell books. One thing I've been doing for you, I've been collecting email addresses, so I put them all, I send out twice a year, I send out a newsletter. I only do it every six months, so I'm not bugging people, but I give them an update on what's going on. And I started doing this before the book came out, and it's just kind of an update of what I'm up to, and I use something called MailChimp, MailChimp.com. It's free, it sends out your emails, your newsletters, helps you manage your list.
Only up to 500 though, right?
And then you have to pay. Was it $2,000 a month? And then you have to pay. I have like 500 and I only send it, I don't send it out that often. But the nice thing is, so my email list, it's friends, former coworkers. I mean, these are people I know. And on the right, you can't really see it that well, but it tells you who opened the email. So you know, like, who to ignore the next time you see them at a cocktail party, and you know who's at, you know, who's reading your emails. So this is the last one I sent out. Actually, it was like probably about a year ago. So I've been doing this. So I put together my own book tour, which was basically I was going doing these fringe festivals, and I would contact local bookstores, and I would do a talk there. And my book sales were not particularly good, so I sent out this newsletter saying, hey, you jerks, buy my book. And actually, it got generated like three or four sales. Things that didn't work, Twitter, independent bookstores. Some of them are, can I curse on here?
Yeah, sure.
Some of them are assholes. And I'm going to give you an example right now. Things that I'm not sure whether they worked or not, Facebook, I kept the blog. I don't know whether these generated any sales. Twitter was a big waste of time. I'm not going to go into too much detail now, but there's ways of tracking this stuff. So the issue with, okay, so independent bookstores, Porter Square, fabulous. I did a reading there. They sent out, it's a pretty big bookstore, so they get picked up, any of their events get picked up by the local papers. They send a note around to all their email subscribers about my book. This was listed on their website. I did a version of this presentation there. They had the whole thing set up. They gave me this nice water bottle that says I read at Porter Square. I had like 20 or 30 people there. Most of them were people that knew me. They bought a bunch of books. They were great. Next to it is in Salt Lake City. There's an independent bookstore there. They had me come in and do a talk. I sold one book. And I sold one ticket to my show, but they were very nice about it. They didn't charge me. There's no charge for any of this stuff. You come in, they buy a bunch of books.
We'll give you a pencil. There's a Gloucester Writer Center pencil.
Thank you. I'll put it right here in my swag collection.
Yeah.
Now, assholes. This is a bookstore. They have three stores. One of them is in Andover. And if you go to their website, Well, down at the bottom, they want to charge you $100 to mention your book in one of their emails. So Porter Square did it for free. Salt Lake City did it for free. They also want to charge you $250 to have an event in their store. You know, so independent bookstores for years, they've been like, oh, we're independent. Oh, you know, help us out. We're artists. We're supporting artists. And these guys are not. There's a bunch of stores like this where they want to charge you. And yeah, you and I have to. Yeah, this is not very nice.
Not nice.
Not nice at all. Okay, so I'm still out promoting it. But one thing that I want to show you is, this is actually about my show, which is similar to the book. I don't have a pointer. But in the first column, it's 2015. So basically the heading for this slide is I'm blaming Donald Trump for my bad book sales. My book is, you know, it's about kind of a little bit about white guys behaving badly. Not a good topic anymore. So pre-Trump, 2015, those are reviews for my show. 4 stars, that was up in Winnipeg. Edinburgh, a quality solo show, great. Trump gets nominated 2016. Vancouver, Fringe Festival, charming with a side of creepy. That's charming's nice, but the creepy stuff's not gonna sell a lot of books or bring a lot of people to the show. 2017, Trump's in office for a year. So at these fringe festivals, what they do is, in order to make it affordable for the performers, people put you up in their home. Locals in the community, you know, give you a spare bedroom and don't charge you for it. It's called billeting. So I was at the Ottawa Fringe Festival. I'm performing there, and the people I'm staying with come to see my show. And after the show, they bolt out of there. And the next day, I'm having breakfast with them, and I turn to the husband. And I said, you know, hey, thanks for coming to my show. And he says, it wouldn't have been the same without you. And then silent treatment for the next 2 days. So I'm seeing these people walking, you know, I'm walking around the house, and I was there for 2 weeks. After a couple of days, it kind of calmed down, but so they didn't like the show. They had the Canadian, the CBC, which is their local radio station. This was on nonstop, and it was all Trump this and America bashing, and all, you know, it was just, this is what they played around the clock in the house. So so that was not a good experience. 2018, Trump gets in a pissing match with Canada, and this past summer, I was performing up in Edmonton, and I got my review, says 2 stars, misogynistic, racist, and xerophobic. You're a nurse. You know, I had to look up what xerophobic is. So xerophobic is like someone that has a thing about blood diseases. And I was like, what does this have to do with my show? So actually, in the book and in the show, there's a scene that takes place in South Africa. And South Africa is ground zero for HIV. So I make mention of it in the show. And the reviewer says, xerophobic. So 2-star review, Donald Trump's fault. This is kind of where we are right now. But I'm done with Canada. Actually, the thing is that I got a bad review in Canada. People still came to the show.
They're very nice.
They're not so nice. But that's the largest fringe festival in North America. So a lot of people that go to the festival don't pay any attention to the reviews. They go, they see something, if they think it's edgy or funny or interesting, they'll go see it. So we were talking about persistence before, especially in marketing and sending your book out and all this stuff. So last year, Airbnb started doing something in Boston called experiences. So they were looking for people that want to host events. You're not hosting people in your house. You're putting on some kind of event for people. So I pitched them where I was going to do my show in my apartment, and I called it Tiny Theater Comes to Boston. So I put together a press release. I sent this out to all the theater reviewers in Boston, and actually I got Joyce Haywick emailed me back and asked me when the show was. I mentioned a bunch of dates, never heard from her again. But so basically, I do the show in my apartment. I've got some special lighting. I've got a black material that I hang from the ceiling, so it looks like a little black box. I've done 4 shows, sold 3 books. I get $15 a ticket if people show up. And it did get picked up. So my tiny theater press release got picked up by something called Arts Fuse, which is a small art email newsletter in Boston, and the Somerville paper.
The woman who does that, she's a good writer.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they gave me a nice little write-up. Somerville Scout, which is my local paper, they used my photo, and I had a nice interview on the phone. Did this sell any books? Doubtful. But, you know, my name is out there. Who knows? The next thing I'm trying is, so the Chronic Singles Handbook, the one that got all these bad reviews that's offending everybody, I learned my lesson. So I'm doing a new show. It's going to be called Tales of a Reluctant World Traveler, which is going to be kind of based on this slideshow. So this is going to be something that's going to be PG. I'm not going to offend anybody. I went up on my website and I took down all the videos from the show. Anything racy or that could be construed as offensive, I took it down. I had a video of something. Actually, I did it here for you guys called The Day I Was Almost Gay. That video came down. I did that at Passim some years ago, and they liked it. But that came down. Something else I did up here called Bangkok. Bangkok. I did that for you guys. You guys liked it. It went over fine. But I took that down off my website, so there's nothing up there that can offend anybody. So this is the new show I'm working on. And so you kind of keep at it. And yes, I spend all this time on this marketing, and no, I don't have a regular job. I took some money out of my savings, and I'm spending a few years seeing if I can sell some books, make some money at this. So I'm working on a second book. I'm halfway through it. The permanent press has first right of refusal. Actually, I called them and said, hey, my book sales for the first one weren't great. And the publisher said, no, they weren't great. And I said, do you still want to see the second book? He said, yeah, we publish books that we like. We lose money on books every year. We're a small press. This is what we do. So I'm halfway through a second book. And that's kind of where I am right now.